Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming challenges of income inequality, corruption, global warming, and the big data surveillance state that we face, and discuss the absence of a progressive agenda to deal with these challenges as America and most of the developed nations move to the right politically, digging the hole deeper. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, joins us to look into where the likely change will come from as the Reagan-Thatcher right-wing revolution runs out of steam, leaving the bankrupt political landscape open. Then we look into the humanitarian disaster in Southeast Asia as persecuted Rohingya Muslims flee Burma, Myanmar in rickety boats that are adrift in the Andaman Sea after being turned away by Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Julianne Schober, an anthropologist who studies Buddhist practice in Burma, Myanmar, joins us to discuss the unfolding tragedy and the forced statelessness of the Rohingya who are fleeing to neighboring Muslim countries which don't want to take them in. Then finally, we'll examine tactics Republican political operatives are using to drive a wedge between liberal Democrats and Hillary Clinton with Ken Goldstein, a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, who is one of the country's premier experts on the use and impact of political advertising. He joins us to assess Hillary's vulnerabilities and the meltdowns on the Republican side as their leading presidential candidate ties himself in knots trying to explain his position on the Iraq War. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is a former managing editor of Ramparts and was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Good to be with you, Ian. It's nice to hear your voice.
And Richard, do you think that given the dissatisfaction or the disquiet that in some of the liberal quarters on the Democratic side and the sort of pining, if you will, for Elizabeth Warren, and now, of course, we have Bernie Sanders entering the race as well on Hillary's left, is there – do you think there is a serious challenge brewing on the left for Hillary Clinton, and do you think that the Republicans can exploit it in any way?
I think there's a rhetorical challenge brewing on the left of Hillary Clinton that she has to pay attention to. Whether there is an electoral candidate who could challenge her in the primaries is much more difficult to say. I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to be effective in terms of numbers of votes he'll get. Elizabeth Warren is the dream candidate of the Democratic left, but she has been pretty consistent so far. She's my senator from here in Massachusetts, and I talk with many senior people in her office on a pretty regular basis, and they are not getting signals from her. She's talking one way and plans to move another with the messages she's saying out. So Hillary Clinton and her people have to understand that they're under the left, and already you can see her rhetorically modifying stances, starting to express concern about Wall Street, starting to express concern about inequality, because she needs those voters to turn out. But that's not the same thing as a challenge to disrupt her campaign. She was sorely tested and lost, as you'll recall, in 2008 through inattentiveness to such a potential challenge. She's not going to do that again.
So do you think that – I mean, one of the things I find interesting is that she's going to be challenged by the Republicans who will try and paint her as a leftist. I mean, after all, her college thesis on Saul Alinsky? Do you think they can make any hay out of that at the same time?
Ian, you and I are old enough to remember that back in the 1950s, the John Birch Society painted Dwight Eisenhower as a tool of the communists. So I don't think that there's any surprise that they're going to try to paint her as a leftist. They did the same thing with Obama. I don't think it's an issue of what catches on with their voters. I mean, we still have 15 or, well, it's actually a higher percentage of Republicans, something like 30% of Republicans still believe that Barack Obama is a foreign-born national. So once a belief takes hold in that community, it's hard to disrupt. The measure is whether or not they can use those narratives that appeal to their base to do one of two things or both, one of which is to discourage turnout or to shift turnout in their direction. I don't think yet that the Clinton campaign is showing signs of being worried. I was in Washington last week, talked to several officials in the campaign. They don't sound like they're worried right now. They're very clearly focused, but I wouldn't call them worried about a threat from the right.
Well, at this point, though, it's as though Hillary Clinton doesn't have to do anything. On the other side, the field is so crowded that it's hard to imagine how they're going to conduct debates with maybe even 20 people on stage. And then you've got these meltdowns, particularly this week, where Jeb Bush simply did not was incapable of answering the questions of whether or not he would have gone into Iraq like his brother did, and he changed his tune several times. And lo and behold, just on Sunday, on the Sunday talk shows, Marco Rubio got himself into the same tongue-twisted explanations about Iraq. So in a way that it's sort of one's always felt that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney got away with quite a bit in terms of an historical condemnation for what happened in Iraq, and particularly with the use of torture. These issues still are out there, but maybe Iraq, there will be a final reckoning here in this election. Do you think it's going to be a significant part of the election narrative, or is it just an early blip?
So for people like you and me, Ian, I mean, the use of torture, the use of rendition, the use of drone strikes today, whether against U.S. citizens or civilians of any kind, is a horrifying prospect. We just saw the United Nations release a report condemning U.S. Human rights practices. And it went virtually unnoticed in the U.S. press. I would dare say not more than 2% of the American population know that the U.N. has released the report. So do I think that there's going to be a reckoning inside the Republican Party or among voters about the Republican Party's legacy in Iraq and Afghanistan? No, because the Democrats are not willing to carry the accusation to them, and you need a two-party framework in order to get the mainstream press comfortable with handling that kind of accusation. The press by itself is sometimes able to first raise an objection, as you know the Times did with the Abu Ghraib pictures, or that other journalists historically, Cy Hirsch publishing the My Lai massacre, or the Times and the Post running the Pentagon Papers. But those bursts of press indignation aren't sustainable without one of the two parties being willing to stand up and really carry the fight forward. And the Democrats are by no means willing to bring criminal charges against the former president or former vice president. And I don't think that Mrs. Clinton, Senator Clinton, or Secretary Clinton is going to be willing to make too much of an issue of it unless the fight is brought to her. You know, right now, friends of mine in Washington are referring to this campaign as Snow White and the 70 Little Dwarves. And she is going to try to do two things, one of which is not seem to float monarchically above the fray. The last thing she needs to do is be nailed with that Queen Victoria image that she had in 2008. She's not going to do that. At the same time, she as much as possible wants to let the hamsters chew away at one another and to an extent let the press and the public draw their own judgment about their capacity for governance. And until we get further on in the process and we winnow out most of the second tier and we get down to two or three viable possible challengers, and once upon a time I would have said immediately Jeb Bush, now I still think Jeb Bush, but I'm more uncertain, Walker, and then possibly one or two others, until that happens, she does not need to go into hand-to-hand combat with her Republican opponent. Let them savage each other.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is a former managing editor of Ramparts and was co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. And his books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. And in terms of the overall issues of the day in this country, which at least I think are where the debate should be. I'm not having any influence in this regard, but it would seem to me that
you persuaded me.
Right. Well, if the debate was about preserving our democracy as it sort of morphs into a plutonomy and a plutocracy or an oligarchy. And it seemed to me that would be a very powerful narrative and one that might well people may well relate to as billions pour into this election. And we see the activities of the Koch brothers and others and all of the – on the Republican side, they're all sort of kneeling before the Koch brothers and kissing their ring in order to get money from them or from Sheldon Adelson. So it does seem like a plutocratic kind of free-for-all on but I don't know how Hillary Clinton can get out from under the fact that her husband seems to like to hang out with rich people and his foundation's been getting a lot of money from fat cats.
Well, you know, look, Ian, I mean, it may well be that this cycle, this long Reagan cycle that started in the mid-1970s, even before Reagan was elected, still has one or two more elections to run. At the same time, I think that it's quite clear that there are four large issues ahead of America. In fact, there are four large issues ahead of the world, and the first is growing inequality, and that's of income, of wealth, of power, and access to resources, tangible and intangible. The second is corruption, which is a kind of pervasive moral decay which exists almost ubiquitously and can range from the very large to the very small. But the more you talk to voters or citizens around the world, and you use things like the Pew polls that do global capture of views, you see that corruption is the thing that's most associated with people's disillusionment. The third is that you've got a question of how big data is going to be used. Snowden and the NSA have made quite clear what the damaging and dangerous ways are that big data can be used. And yet the left has yet to figure out how it can lay claim to this new technology in ways that would position progressive politics to take advantage of those tools and those techniques, including both closer monitoring of government, closer monitoring of corporations, and closer monitoring of the press. And I think it was just at the very beginnings of what we can do here. I mean, for example, the International Committee of Investigative Journalists broke that terrific story about HSBC. And it was a story, this British bank and its Swiss unit that was hiding thousands and thousands of secret accounts from around the world that people were using to avoid taxes. And it was a coordinated effort by journalists from more than a dozen countries. And the way they were able to do it was that computers and the Internet allowed them to work on their stories, tailor them and specialize them for their own particular countries, and yet make the global connections that help readers or viewers around the world understand just how profoundly interconnected corruption is and how easily it passes borders. And then I think the fourth, beyond inequality, corruption, and how to use big data, is the question of the environment writ large. It's climate change, it's pollution, it's the stress of resources. We really are at this incredible historical tipping point of having created an anthropogenic era in the life of the planet that has never existed before and seems to be damaging the planet's vital systems in ways that may be irreparable and certainly represent a kind of a danger that rivals any crisis in human history and perhaps any crisis or one or two crises in the planet's history. So you've got these enormous issues. These candidates are not capable of talking about any of them meaningfully. And so people at the margins, politically in terms of current institutional power, need to keep bringing them to public attention. The public is not ignorant of this. We're in a situation not unlike the fight for the abolition of slavery in the first half of the 19th century. But the political system, the electoral system, the business system was not ready to engage that issue. And it took decades of preaching and propagandizing and educating and going back again and again and again that discouraged so many people trying to make change, and yet ultimately it does lead to change.
But given what you've just outlined, the great challenges facing both the United States and the planet itself, and just in terms of inequality, there was an extraordinary study recently by Oxfam that found that 85 families control about half of the wealth of the entire globe. And climate change, which is becoming more and more manifest in spite of the active efforts on the part of denialists, et cetera. But when you look at how the politics of the world seem to be shaping up, you know, in the last election, the Republicans won. In the UK, the Conservatives won. Almost all of the countries in the developed world have moved to the right. Australia has an extremely right-wing climate change denier running Australia. The Canadians moved to the right. Probably the French will again. Sarkozy is going to come back. Israel moved to the right. You just go down the list. So what's happening there in terms of the disconnect between the politics and the challenges?
So I think that the rise of the modern left in the 19th century and its successes across the first half of the 20th century were built on the particular traumas, joint traumas of nationalism and capitalism. Nationalism seemed to draw Europe and European offshoots into an endless series of wars that began, you know, the French and Indian Wars that were part of this larger 30-year war in the 18th century, and then continued on globally, not necessarily in Europe after the Napoleonic period, before the First World War, but across the world as Europe expanded. So the imminence of war and the fact that war meant men were being drawn off of farms, out of factories, out of towns, and the loss of life was considerable and constant, and the fear of war was palpable, has changed now in the 21st century. The developed world is indifferent to the prospect of war. It's a different world from that of the 1960s or 70s or 80s when the bipolarity of the West and communism meant that atomic war was always potentially imminent. 10,000 nuclear weapons still exist, but I don't think that there's anybody who reasonably believes that Strategic Air Command needs to be on high alert because there's some prospect of imminent nuclear conflict. So that's one. The second is that, you know, the left is oftentimes incapable of acknowledging the bounty that capitalism has produced. We can talk about the asymmetries of access. We can talk about the exploitation of the creation of that bounty. But if you want to talk about caloric intake, you want to talk about lifespan, you want to talk about freedom of movement, you want to talk about levels of education, this is a profoundly different world in the developed world, and catching up in the other parts of the world, but in the developed world, from the world 200 years ago or even 100 years ago. And I think that that thick layer of, I don't want to call it contentment, but that thick layer of privilege, of achievement, of opportunity, of, if in nothing else, having something that you're afraid to lose, whereas 150 years ago there were hundreds of millions of people who had nothing to lose in rising against the state and rising against monarchy and rising against early capitalism. I think those two factors, nationalism plus this sense that enough has been distributed to enough people in the West that it has tempered, if not killed off, their kind of demands for dramatic, even violent change, has put the left of center parties in a real dilemma, because it means that the left of center parties, working through the electoral system, have to appeal to a broad middle class. They recognize that as you move down the income scale, voter participation, voter attention, voter concern with the electoral system falls, And it means that you're fighting with conservative right-of-center parties for the votes of sometimes 70, sometimes 60, sometimes 50% of the electorate, which is almost inevitably drawn from the upper, not the lower reaches of society. And so, you know, with the collapse of the long Roosevelt era in the 1970s after an extraordinary 40-year run, conservatism emerged and liberalism led, the left shifted rightward with the weight of the tectonic shift led by Thatcher, led by Cole, led by Reagan, et cetera. And we're coming out of that period, but we don't have a defined idea of where we ought to be going. We're a bit like the Democratic Party was adrift between the First World War and Wilson's incapacitation and the arrival of Roosevelt in 1933. We're waiting, waiting, waiting. It doesn't mean we have to sit idly by, but, you know, the congruence of global forces has not emerged. Now, given the rise of Chinese power, you know, the configuration of how those forces will act and react is a guess. We don't know. The United States is very shortly not going to be the world's largest economy, which it's been since the 1880s. And with that shift, it's going to go a shift in power and status and all kinds of ability to achieve what it is that our elites think is most advantageous to them. So, you know, it's a very complex situation. It may well be that the push for democracy rises in those countries, particularly in East Asia, among a middle class or a working class that finds itself discontent with the golden handcuffs that authoritarian, you know, crypto-capitalism, I don't know what the phrase is for it, is imposing across that population. So, you know, it's not clear that the history-making change that will lead in the direction of the Western left has, you know, led for 250 years, will in the next 250 years be led by a Western left. It may be the Western left reacting to forces that are progressive in other parts of the world.
Well, Richard Parker, you've given us a lot to think about, and I very much appreciate it, and I thank you for joining us.
Ian, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Always good to talk with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former managing editor of Ramparts and was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the humanitarian disaster in Southeast Asia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julianne Schober, who is the Professor of Religious Studies at Arizona State University, where she's also Director of the Center for Asian Research and Co-Director of Graduate Studies in Religious Studies, an anthropologist who works on the Theravada Buddhist practice in Southeast Asia, especially in Burma, Myanmar. She's the author of Modern Buddhist Conjectures in Myanmar, Cultural Narratives, Colonial Legacies, and Civil Societies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julianne Schober.
Thank you for having me.
And Julianne, there's this ongoing tragedy in the Andaman Sea, which is rivals the Mediterranean tragedies, which we've been all too familiar with in the last several months. But the idea that the BBC is reporting that 100 people died after a fight broke out over the last remaining food aboard an overcrowded vessel full of the Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar, and also there's an exodus of Bangladeshi men and women and children who are fleeing persecution and poverty at home, and they all seem to be, they originally were heading for Thailand and would make their way into Malaysia, but the Thais have closed off that border, and many are just ending up in drifting and adrift and coming ashore in Indonesia. And Malaysia's already taken in 120,000 from migrants from Myanmar. So what's driving the people out of their country, the Muslims that are being driven out of Myanmar?
Well, that's a good question and not an easy answer. And surely the images that we've seen in recent days are horrific, of those migrations and absolute stark conditions under which they take place. And I think what we're looking at is just an epiphenomenon, a glimpse of the surface of a number of different networks that lie underneath those images. Just to give you a little bit of a sense of the region, the Bay of Bengal and the Andaman Sea have long been at the core of a regional trade network where people would migrate and move across what today we think of as national borders, but what haven't always been national borders. And with those movements of, say, people from what is today Bangladesh into Burma and also from Burma elsewhere, over centuries, ethnic designations and the way in which people constructed their ethnic identities also changed. So the Rohingya are a group today of Muslims living on northern Arakan, adjacent to Bangladesh, who are experiencing pressures from a variety of different directions that make them move, make them want to migrate. And one of their preferred destinations, of course, is another Muslim country, maybe Malaysia, maybe Indonesia. So what makes Rohingya seek out these trade networks of essentially networks of people smuggling out of Myanmar today is a history of exclusion and violence and segregation in very stark terms. There are probably around a million Rohingya, it's not quite clear, living in that region of northern Arakan, one of the states in what is today known as Myanmar. And since the end of World War II, Myanmar, or Burma, as it was known then when it became independent from the British, was and still continues to be engaged in a process of negotiating its boundaries as a modern nation state, which means that it has to, the ruling government, the ruling group, has to come to some kind of understanding of who belongs to Myanmar. And from time to time, it has been that Muslims in particular and Rohingya in this region have been targeted as somebody who does not belong to the new Union of Myanmar. In fact, the government defines sort of an imaginary number of 135 ethnic groups, and they say, well, the Rohingya are not among them. Of course, we know as anthropologists that those kinds of ethnic classifications are really a product of colonial scholarship, and no one today really subscribes to them in the same way. And we recognize that ethnic identities shift and ethnic allegiances also change over time. So it seems that the Burmese ruling class has defined Rohingya out of existence by simply calling them Bengali and denying them citizenship on the basis of they cite a law that was enacted in 1982 that makes it very difficult for anyone, for any minority, to claim Burmese citizenship. It's difficult because it requires documentation going back over 60 years or three generations to show that you and your family owned land, that you have continuously lived there, et cetera, et cetera. And that's very difficult in the country where and among people that don't rely on paper necessarily as the primary technology for recording ownership of land, for example. So the standards for being counted as Burmese, if you're Muslim Rohingya, are very, very difficult to attain. And in recent months and years, following violent incidents against the Rohingya that put many of them into concentration camps, there have been some efforts to create a process for documenting citizenship for those who had been there over three generations and so on. But that also, I think, was a process that was largely unsuccessful for most Rohingya, and hence the pressure to seek out illegal human smuggling networks that transport more and more people from that contested region on the border between Bangladesh and northern Arakan in Burma. More and more people are seeking to escape those pressures, of economic pressures, of pressures of discrimination, pressures that don't allow them to envision a future where they are, and seek out opportunities elsewhere by any means they can create for themselves.
Again, I'm speaking with Julianne Schober, who is a professor of religious studies at Arizona State University, where she's also the director of the Center for Asian Research and co-director of graduate studies in religious studies, an anthropologist who works on Theravada Buddhist practice in Southeast Asia, especially in Burma, Myanmar. She's the author of Modern Buddhist Conjectures in Myanmar, Cultural Narratives, Colonial Legacies, and Civil Societies. So this tragedy at sea that rivals what's been going on in the Mediterranean is being driven clearly by the Buddhist majority in Burma or Myanmar. And, of course, most of the popular imagination about Buddhists are that they're extremely gentle people. But this is clearly not the case, right? This is pretty ruthless what's going on.
Well, and I guess the reality is that any time you deal with the history of religious traditions, you realize that ideals are not always translated flawlessly into the practices of everyday life. I think that that's true for Buddhists, but it's also true for just about any other religion. And if anything, I guess we have to come to a point where we don't romanticize religious ideals, but perhaps particularly Buddhist ideals in the way in which we've been used to doing. So in Myanmar, which has a very strong Buddhist tradition that is closely tied to national identity, to the ethnic identity of the majority population, to the identity of a particular ruling class. And by that, I'm referring to a very well-established institution and class of people who have been trained and disciplined by the Burmese military over more than one generation now. They very much see themselves as Burmese, as Buddhist, and they see their nation as Burmese and Buddhist. It hasn't always been the case that that was a marked identity. I can remember times when being Burmese and Buddhist was quite natural to many Burmese, but it was also natural to then go and celebrate Muslim holidays or Christian holidays at a time when religion wasn't such a heightened focus of popular attention. But that has certainly changed. And it's also important to remember that it has been occurring from time to time. It's not just recent that Burmese military take, or Burmese popular movements take action against Muslims. It has occurred at various junctures over the past century, and the most recent outbreak of violence is just and emphasis on Buddhist nationalism and the perception of Buddhism under threat. That's just the most recent chapter of a rather longer history. And I think it is a history that chronicles a debate, and that debate is around the question of who belongs to Myanmar and what kind of political system should that state have, really since independence, but more specifically since it began to open up to the West at the end of 2011. And we're looking ahead at elections at the end of this year, 2015, that might solidify the path towards the future in one way or the other, either towards a more controlled form of liberalization or a more genuine democratic form that embraces a certain kind of federalism where ethnic voices are represented in the central institutions of the country and so on. And I think that's really what the debate is about. Some have argued that the violence against Rohingya and against Muslim has occurred generally at a time when the government in power had reason to deflect from concerns going on, like an upcoming election, or
But meanwhile, and we're pretty much run out of time, Julianne. But meanwhile, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are adrift at sea. They're being turned away. They're smuggling, people smuggling route, and the secret slave camps inside Thailand have been closed down. The Malaysian Navy is turning away these boats. This is a terrible humanitarian catastrophe. So
It is an absolutely horrific catastrophe, and one that none of the Southeast Asian nations are really stepping up to, I suppose. The Regional Association of Southeast Asian Nation is not an organization that is primarily collaborative. Its purpose is more to safeguard each other's existence. And so it's not, unfortunately, Rohingya are not welcome by any of the neighboring nations. Bangladesh, Thailand, Malaysia has, as you said, taken more than 100,000, but they are truly a stateless group, and so the UN has spoken out about this on several occasions, but it has become an international crisis, international humanitarian crisis.
Well, Julianne Schober, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Julianne Schober, who is a professor of religious studies at Arizona State University. She's also the director of the Center for Asian Research and co-director of graduate studies in religious studies. And she's an anthropologist who works on Theravada Buddhist practice in Southeast Asia, especially in Burma, Myanmar, and is the author of Modern Buddhist Conjectures in Myanmar, Cultural Narratives, Colonial Legacies, and Civil Societies. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into tactics Republican political operatives are using to drive a wedge between Liberal Democrats and Hillary Clinton. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ken Goldstein, who's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and one of the country's premier experts on the use and impact of political advertising. He has also consulted for the ABC News Elections Unit and is a member of their Election Night Decision Team and has worked on network Election Night coverage in every U.S. federal election since 1988. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ken Goldstein.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the New York Times is reporting that Republican operatives now are sort of baiting the left to drive a wedge between Hillary Clinton and liberal Democrats. And what's your sense of whether or not this will be successful, given that already a lot of liberal Democrats are sort of wishing that Elizabeth Warren was running, and we already have Bernie Sanders running. So in terms of a tactic, what's your sense of this, whether it'll work or not?
So, listen, in a fundamental sense, this is not a new tactic, and it's actually a tactic that we've seen Democrats use against Republicans to get involved in another side's primary. And you can do that for two reasons, either because you really think you can shape the primary and get a candidate that you'd rather run against. And we saw the Democrats do that in Missouri, and they wanted to run against Todd Akin, and they got in the campaign in 2012. And Democrats wanted to try and influence the Republican primary. They felt, and they felt, and it turned out accurately, that one of Republican potential nominees would be a much weaker general election candidate. So they ran advertising in a Democratic primary, attacking one of the Republican candidates for being too conservative, which, of course, helped that candidate in a Republican primary. We saw something similar in California previously, where Democrats did not want to run against Mayor Reardon from Los Angeles, so got involved in a Republican primary. So, again, you can do this for one of two reasons. One, because you actually think you can influence the primary. The second reason is because you're trying to get the candidate to take some positions in the primary that then may hurt them in a general election. So Hillary Clinton doesn't want to say anything until the general election campaign and wants to be able to speak to swing voters while retaining a base on the left. But if she's forced to answer to folks on the left. That will move her to the left in the Democratic primary, which the Republicans think will be advantageous to them in the general election. You know, but what's interesting is primaries are a time also where you can influence people's stance. So Bill de Blasio and Elizabeth Warren are, Elizabeth Warren may not be running, and Bill de Blasio is a supporter of Hillary Clinton, but they have all these activities where they're trying to get Hillary Clinton and the balance of power in the Democratic Party to move to the left. So it is not your traditional alliance between Bill de Blasio and the Koch brothers, but that's what we seem to have here in the short term.
But in terms of the actual technique, sending out these misleading tweets, I guess, what exactly are they doing? How are they conning Democrats into thinking that these tweets are coming from, in the case, one case here is Bill McKibben, who's an environmental activist who's single-handedly started this Keystone XL pipeline protest, and other fairly prominent people on the political left have been sort of basically they've been usurped and co-opted or unwittingly to criticize Hillary, and obviously it must be working to some extent.
So, I mean, that language is a tad strong. Listen, it is It is not your basic strategy. That said, it really doesn't differ very much than Democratic campaigns airing ads against Republicans in a Republican primary. So what they're doing is they're putting out information, and that information is then getting passed along by either consumed by Democrats or, when they really hit it, passed along by Democrats. So again, I think it is a strategy that's a little bit more than what you typically do, right? Typically, in a general election, you're sort of looking to put together your coalition. Here, it's trying to look many, many months ahead and trying to influence the positions that a candidate takes or the nominee that's yielded from a Democratic primary, and you're putting messages out. And sometimes you put messages out by spinning to reporters. Sometimes you put messages out by airing advertisements. And sometimes now in this new world you are, you put out messages on social media. And every once in a while, you get someone gullible to pass it along.
I see. So this is not any grand Machiavellian plan. This is like throwing something against the wall and see if it sticks.
Well, I mean, you know. Everything's a plan in politics, right? Mm-hmm. And these folks have they've got some money and they got some time on their hands, so they're able to play around with this. So I ultimately think this is going to have a huge impact on the election. Probably not, but it is certainly part of a greater effort by Republicans to get Hillary to talk more during the primary. So it's not so much to damage Hillary and have her take, you know, incoming shells during the Democratic primary. It's more to try and have her respond to the left, which Republicans think will hurt her with swing voters when we get to a general election.
So they've made that calculus there, that she's vulnerable on the left. And I think it's pretty evident that that is the case. So do you think that they have a lot of room to maneuver in that area in terms of tapping into a disquiet that already exists?
You know, interesting. You know, the question is whether they've made the determination that she's vulnerable on the left or that she's vulnerable on the center, right? So, and I think it's a little bit of both. That, you know, clearly there's a lot of progressives who would wish for another challenger to Hillary Clinton. That said, I mean, you look at the polling data among progressives and Democrats. Hillary Clinton has overwhelming support of those folks. So. Maybe a little bit in Brooklyn, a little bit in San Francisco, a little bit in Berkeley, a little bit in Madison, Wisconsin, you have some folks pining for someone who's much more on the left. But when you look at most of the folks who are going to make up the Democratic primary electorate, there does not seem to be any huge desire for another nominee. But what the Republicans are looking for is people who aren't going to be involved in the primary. And it's all about the base. It's all about the base. But swing voters ultimately will matter in places like Ohio and Nevada and Wisconsin and Iowa and places like that. And if Republicans can bait Hillary Clinton into saying something stupid in the primaries or saying something that pushes her farther to the left in the primaries, that can help them in the general election in the very same way that Mitt Romney was forced to move to the right in the Republican primaries in 2012, and then that hurt him in the general election.
So what's your sense then of how Jeb Bush is doing as a candidate? Because over the course of 72 hours, he had to sort of reverse himself, claimed he misunderstood the interviewer's question, and then on Thursday, he finally answered the original question and basically, I guess, you know, didn't really come across as being particularly clear about his position on the Iraq war, although he eventually did say that he would not have gone into Iraq.
Yes, listen, Jeb Bush unambiguously had a very bad week. There's no doubt about that. And I think if you're the Hillary Clinton campaign, and you're getting a bunch of people, you're getting a bunch of reporters, and you're even getting a bunch of people on the left saying, "Hey, you should talk more." When you look at Jeb Bush's week, you go, "We're going to be happy to have all you people on the radio criticize us for not talking enough and trying not to say anything stupid."
And what's extraordinary is that Marco Rubio sort of he stumbled in exactly the same way on Sunday on Fox News after Jeb Bush's bad week.
Yeah, and it was interesting because Rubio's first answer to it during the week was a perfectly fine answer, which is knowing what I know now, I wouldn't have supported it, but knowing what I thought we knew at the time, I would have. And that's a perfectly valid answer in a Republican primary. I think that's a perfectly valid answer. But listen, you have a selection effect, right? One reason why people get into politics is they have great self-confidence in their speaking ability. So sometimes it's hard to get them to stop talking.
So what's your sense then of when it'll be clearer? I mean, who can actually run this gauntlet? I mean, it's interesting that so much of the advance notices about Jeb Bush was that he was supposedly the favorite son, and that George W. was the family second choice, if you will. But it's beginning to look like, you know, that George W. did have some natural political abilities. He was the guy that everybody wanted to have a beer with. But as you learn more and more about Jeb Bush, it doesn't seem like he's particularly magnetic. And I'm wondering whether that will be the case with some of these other candidates. Is that, I guess, you know, that's the one virtue of this endlessly long election season, is that it's a pretty grueling gauntlet that they run, and you have ample opportunity to see who, or at least as much as you can, who the real people are.
I agree with that. Listen, it's a long season. It's like a baseball season. You can't hide your warts over 162 games, and it's hard to hide your warts over the course of a presidential election. I'm always wary when people say they've never seen anything like it before. But in terms of what's going on in the Republican primary and just the number of candidates competing for the Republican nomination, I've never seen anything like it before. And also the ability of outside groups. We may have seen primaries before in which there were a lot of candidates. There's even more this time. Plus, some of these candidates are going to be able to stick in longer because they can have outside groups supporting them with resources. Listen, again, I think Jeb Bush had a very bad week. Does not mean he's not going to be the Republican nominee. But again, it's certainly a very bad week. And anyone who tells you that they know how the chips are going to fall as the Republican primary season starts, there's just no way to know at this point. I mean, there's certainly some top tier candidates, but it is really hard to be that football coach and say, "Hey, that's just how I drew it up."
Well, it's sort of interesting, though, isn't it, that, you know, at this point, in particularly with them campaigning in Iowa, that so much of the focus is on sort of pandering to the religious right because of their importance in Iowa. But all these other, particularly the ghosts of Iraq, seem to be dominating the narrative. And so you can never predict these things, can you?
Well, and again, Iraq would be, I think, more of a general election issue. So things that Jeb Bush says now might have more of an influence in the general election. And again, it's, because I was the first, because I was going to be so important for a number of candidates who really need a ticket out of Iowa, there definitely will be a focus by Republicans on the sorts of people who come turn out in the Iowa caucuses.
Well, I guess we'll wait with bated breath here. But just in closing, your sense is that the tactics being used against Hillary are not that significant, but the self-inflicted wounds on the Republican side so far are more newsworthy, if not significant.
So I would say, yes, they are interesting, but certainly not a game changer at this point. And listen, we've started covering this race so early that we can sometimes get distracted by the little shiny toys. And I think it's important to keep an eye on the fundamentals. And listen, as we go towards the general election, this presidential election, the general election, is going to much more be decided by Americans' attitudes by Barack Obama, whether they want a change or not, than it is anything going on now. That said, we also live in an era where politics and elections can be decided at the margin. And Jeb Bush's week was not a good week. And the activities of Republicans of trying to create a little havoc for Hillary Clinton on the left and try and have her talk about things that she doesn't want to talk about now, ain't going to move the needle 20 percentage points, but part and parcel of a larger effort from Republicans to not let Hillary Clinton get away scot-free until June of 2016.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Ken Goldstein.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ken Goldstein, who's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and one of the country's premier experts on the use and impact of political advertising. And he's also consulted for the ABC News Election Unit as a member of their Election Night decision team and has worked on network Election Night coverage in every U.S. federal election since 1988. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.